I have some remarks regarding the utility of math. You know, here's the thing. How do you arrive at Karen's time on scene without doing that math problem? It's almost like you need that equation in order to even come up with an estimate for when she arrived.
You need some math.
Yeah, you definitely need at least some math. So if for anyone who questions why someone might be doing the equations for this case, that's the answer. You kind of need at least one.
Nothing that jumps out at this timeline that says anything to me other than what it is. Because it's just not the timeline. It's also eyewitness statements. It's 911 calls. It's Karen McNamara, witness A. And you have to look at the total picture.
Those roads are potholy as hell. She was driving slow. She was driving pretty slow, and Cecil was flying.
The bottom line is, on any of this stuff, there's no gap in here that would indicate anything happened. That's what I come down to when I look at this timeline.
I think one of the biggest standouts to some people is Cecil Smith's arrival time of 7:46.
Actually saying is that Karen Weston lied.
No.
Cecil Smith lied. John Monahan lied. Faith Weston lied.
No.
Chatwood lied. And the Marat lied.
No. All I'm asking is, did he come from the police station?
That question would dismiss every other bit of evidence out there. It does. That's the problem. To me, it's a piece of information that really doesn't mean anything. Now, it would mean something if we were disputing what everybody else said.
Right. I think some people are still disputing who was in 001. I think, and I think that's what you're getting
well,
at.
Well, because people don't like facts to get in the way of a good story.
Welcome back, I'm Aaron. As you could probably guess from the clips we just played, in this episode, Ethan and I discuss the timeline, and we respond to some of the arguments we heard in episode 75 of the Missing Maura Murray podcast. The key difference, of course, in our timeline is that we cannot rule out the possibility that there was another officer on scene prior to Cecil Smith's arrival. But I want to be clear that it is just one possibility. It's one that we believe is worthy of attention and scrutiny, but not to the exclusion of all other possibilities. Just as a disclaimer, this is nothing personal against Art and Maggie at all. I don't think people should lose sight of the fact that we all want the same thing, and that reasonable people can disagree. But I think the one thing we can probably all agree on is that Maura disappeared within that 15 to 20 minute window of time following the crash. From our perspective, that's why the timeline is such a crucial aspect of the case. As always, feel free to reach out to us with any questions, comments, or clarifications.
Yeah. Well, do you want to start with your timeline?
Yeah. So, and I'm going to limit it to sort of the accident scene, that 20, 25 minutes of time. So a lot of the times that I have are similar to Art's timeline with a couple major differences. But the first, I think that we agree that she probably got into the accident around 7:25.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't think it would have taken too much longer than a few minutes for Faith and Tim to have decided to call 911.
Right.
I think we also agree that at 7:27, Faith Westman called the police to report the incident. And there's like a slight difference in when he thinks that Smith was dispatched. He says 7:28 or 7:29. I think it was 7:29, which is what's in the official log.
And there's no disagreement there because he said 7:28 or 29.
Right. As for when Butch came to the scene and spoke to her, I believe Art has that occurring at 7:30 p.m.
Yep.
And in my timeline, Butch arrives at 7:29 and leaves the scene at 7:31. And I don't think that Art has a time that Butch leaves the scene. He just says that he arrives at 7:30. So that's essentially the same as well. Then I have Karen arriving at the scene between 7:33 and 7:37.
Right.
And this is where we start to have a divergence.
This is where the math comes into play.
Right.
And by the way, you know, math to some people implies precision. That is not the case here. Just because we're using math doesn't mean we're saying that someone arrived at exactly a specific time. We're actually using math to place boundaries on earliest or latest time to create a range during which they could have arrived. So what you do is you take, well, what's the fastest this person, given the conditions, could have driven, and you solve the problem there, and then you solve it for what's the slowest we think they would have driven, and that gives you your window of time. So we're not saying that because we're using math that we know all these times exactly and precisely. We're saying kind of the opposite.
Right. We're trying to get reasonable parameters within which it seems possible that he could have arrived.
So that's kind of where the math helps you understand what could or could not have happened.
Right.
In terms of a specific time. Someone throws out a specific time that they think something happened. We can run it through that equation that, speed times time equals distance, or you can rearrange it and make it go different ways. But that can tell you whether or not it works, whether it works under any plausible speed that a person could have been going.
And we do have a precise time in this case because we have her cell phone records, which say 7:52.
Right. And that's the key. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot else that we can really hang our hat on. But no one else can either. That's the thing. You've got to rely on some information. Everyone does. Art relies on logs and calculations of how long it takes people to get places, just like you are, but you're coming to different conclusions.
Right.
Now, why do you have that that range? Are you're basing that on Witness A's sighting?
Right.
And her sighting of the SUV passing her twice and then seeing it at the site.
Yes. So if we backtrack from where she made the call at Beaver Pond at 7:52, that puts her at the scene around, I say, 7:33 to 7:37, depending on how fast she was driving. If she was going the speed limit, she would have arrived at 7:33. If she was speeding a little bit by about 10 miles an hour, she would have arrived at 7:37.
That's, again, just being clear, you're backtracking from the cell phone call at Beaver Pond based on where cell service was possible.
Right.
Yeah. So now if she's driving slower, backtracking from that point, that puts her earlier in time.
Right. So for example, if she was going the speed limit, she would have arrived at 7:33.
Right. So now just to distinguish, if someone was to take Karen's starting time as their point of reference, which we don't know for a fact, but if they were to try to estimate what her starting time was, then the slower Karen drives, the later she passes the scene. But if you're using your reference point, Beaver Pond, the slower she drives, the earlier she arrives at the scene, which I think is an important distinction to make because in the Missing Maura Murray episode, Maggie was talking about, you know, how she was basically making the argument that Karen was driving slower to argue that, you know, Witness A might have passed a little bit later than we're all sort of thinking about. And, you know, it depends on what your point of reference is. So I wanted to ask you, what time do you have Karen leaving work and what is that based on?
So I actually don't have a time for this.
Okay.
I mean, I know that she has said that she probably left around 7:15 or so, but to me, it's irrelevant.
Sure, because we don't really have any idea.
Yeah.
It's just based on her recollection.
It would be nice to know because we could sort of get a more precise mile per hour that she was driving over the entire trip. But to me, it's far less relevant than backtracking because we have a precise time and a precise place.
Right.
In that case.
To work from. Yep.
Yeah.
And again, the slower Karen drives, the earlier she passes the scene, the earlier she sees an SUV.
Mm-hmm.
And now you had the end time at 7:37. So that's the end of your window. And how did you arrive at that?
So that was what I thought was the most reasonable window.
For the fastest she could have driven.
Yes.
So how fast was that?
Yeah, so that would have been 43 miles an hour.
Okay, average.
Uh-huh.
From the accident scene to Beaver Pond.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe in his timeline, Karen was at the accident scene around 7:38, which is after your time window, interestingly, which would either have her driving faster than you thought of her as her maximum speed, faster than 43 miles an hour, or it would have to, I guess, call into question the point at which she was able to obtain cell phone signal, suggesting she got cell phone signal earlier than your estimate. And you actually calculated that based on what you saw, well, Beaver Pond, which is what Karen reported, and what you observed when you were up there, correct? When cell signal dropped.
Yes. And I tested it multiple times. And I have both an AT&T and a Verizon device. So I looked at both.
Yeah. And this is I just have to remark, a lot has changed in 14 years. However, this is a rural area. You would not expect to see much development in terms of cell phone coverage in that area. Certainly, it wouldn't have been better.
Right, exactly. You're not going to have less coverage now.
Yeah.
If anything, you'll have more, but not less.
There's a dead zone. There was almost certainly a dead zone at the time that she was there. So I would say your estimate is probably pretty good. One caveat I would say is we don't know about like atmospheric conditions, which could have an effect on cell service and also like the quality of the phone. Again, your phone's antenna is probably going to be better.
I feel pretty safe saying that my two devices are better.
Yeah.
Than whatever she was using.
Yeah. So if someone wants to make the argument that she got cell service like substantially before, like a mile or more beforehand, they're going to have to explain to me like why, because I don't see it. So all that having been said, Art's timeline is 7:38, which means she would have been going faster than 43 miles an hour average.
Yes. It means she would have been going about 50 miles an hour.
Which is almost impossible on that road.
Yeah. And it's worth pointing out, I think, that it's 35 miles an hour at that particular point, but at other points, because I have driven it multiple times, it's 30 miles an hour. There's one stretch where it is 40 miles an hour, but it's short in relation to the rest of the trip, which is 35 or 30. And I also think that Maggie brought it up. They talked about this in the episode. You have to do the drive to see or to understand, but I don't recall them actually giving any times that it took for them. Do you?
Certainly, I don't recall from the accident site to Beaver Pond.
Yeah, I don't think that they gave the time.
I believe they were tracing Witness A's route, however, not knowing the start time with any degree of certainty whatsoever of Witness A's, Karen's drive. I don't understand what information you could deduce from that.
Right.
I'm really not sure what Maggie's referring to in terms of, because Maggie mentioned that, and you know, these are like windy roads and you can't go that fast. And I would say, yes, I agree. That puts Witness A at the scene, if anything, earlier in time, again, based on the timestamp that we have some way to like say where it occurred. And that's the call at Beaver Pond.
Yes.
And again, just 43 miles an hour was 7:37 based on Beaver Pond and the cell phone call. So she would have been speeding the entire distance.
Yes. At 7:37, she would have been speeding anywhere from 8 to 13 miles an hour on average, which is not unreasonable.
No.
But I put it toward the less likely end of the spectrum for all the reasons we just said about how windy the road is, for everything that Maggie and Art said about the road, which I agree with, and the conditions, it being February and snowy,
yeah,
and there are snowbanks and all of that stuff. She just passed an accident.
She just passed an accident, so yeah. And remarking to Tim and Lance that she didn't drive as fast as them, so she's not a speed demon.
Yeah, so I think it's reasonable to assume that she was probably going about the speed limit.
Yeah, I would say that's reasonable. Listen, when we were up there driving, I was shocked at the speed limits, at how high they were. And I've lived in rural areas before. I grew up in a rural area. The speed limits are high. I mean, for these types of roads, they're very windy. And, you know, living where I live now in suburbia, you would not have these speed limits. And the reason why the speed limits are higher than you would expect is that the population density is so low.
Yeah, you don't have kids playing out on the roads.
Right. I know, at least in Massachusetts, they roughly base the speed limit on the number of houses, like, per whatever many feet. In New Hampshire, that's going to be very low. So the speed limits are going to be on the high side. So you're going to find, when you're driving on the roads, they're like, wow, these speed limits are kind of high for these road conditions. And mm-hmm. that's just because you don't see that many cars, you don't see that many people, so they can kind of increase the limit up to where it's actually like, you feel like this is a little bit unsafe going around these curves at these speeds. And you're actually going to find yourself going a little bit less than the speed limit in a lot of cases.
Yep. Again, it's 30 to 35, but they also have, you know, the corners where it's 20 miles an hour, where like the really windy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you have to slow down. Well, the corner that Moore had the accident on, I mean, you couldn't go that corner more than 20 miles an hour and feel mm-hmm. safe at all. I mean, that is and that's not the only corner like that on that road.
Right.
He, for some reason, has Karen staying at the accident site for a couple minutes.
I think that she said that on the show. I think that she said that she stopped the car and looked back. It was one of the things that I'm not sure I necessarily buy.
Right.
She might have felt like it was a minute or so, but I don't think that she would have stayed for more than a couple of seconds. And, I mean, this might be, maybe it's a good time to bring it up, maybe it's not. But on the subject, if somebody was looking at the scene the entire time, don't you think they would have seen somebody, like Karen, stopped for several minutes?
Yeah. I mean, where did she say she stopped?
It was like sort of in front of Butch's house.
Butch's house. So she passed the scene, she thought, that's weird. She pulled over for a second and then decided to keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it does go to show that not everyone was watching the scene the entire time, or they would have seen it.
Yeah, they would have mentioned that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's interesting looking it over and compared to ours. It's very close, except for Cecil Smith arriving.
Right. So I think that the major point of disagreement is obviously when Smith arrives at the scene.
Sure.
Because Art has him arriving around 7:35, getting out, looking around the car, going to the Westmans, going back out to the SUV, and then radioing back at 7:46.
So Art's timeline hypothesis is that Smith arrived, got out of the car, looked around, saw there was no one in the car, then walked over to the Westmans, spoke to them briefly, comes back to the car, and then at some point radios back, around 7:46, radios back that he is on scene. Mm-hmm. That's Art's theory.
Right.
Which basically would, from his perspective, that explains why Karen saw an SUV at the scene well before 7:46, when
yes.
Smith in the logs shows up as having been at the scene.
Right. But there's no indication, there's no reason to believe that he broke standard protocol and waited 10, 11 minutes before radioing back.
Yeah. And it's like you said, 11 minutes, and that's what, you know, Art's official timeline is.
Right. And then we also have to assume that not only was dispatch off, but the accident report, he arrived 9 minutes or 10 minutes later than he did.
And the accident report, now that's interesting. The accident report says 7:45. Now, where would that timestamp have come from?
I believe that comes from his notes. So remember when Catherine was referring to clocks in cars?
Yes.
And so police also take notes.
Right. Okay, so he might have, in his notepad, he pulls up, mm-hmm. jots down, arrived on scene.
Yep. 7:45.
Gets out, walks around, sees there's no one there, leans back into his car, radios in real quick. Hey, mm-hmm. I'm here. I don't see anybody. I'm going to go talk.
To the Westmans.
To the Westmans. He might have even asked, like, where's that witness? There might have even been chatter, conversation, discussion about where he should go to find the caller. Actually, I never really thought about that before. Why would he know to go to Westmans? I mean, I suppose he could have been on the radio while he was driving, getting an address. But wouldn't it make more sense that he checked back in with dispatch to confirm where the witness was, the person who was on the phone with them?
Yep. That is an excellent question. How did he know to go to the Westmans? How did he know where they were in relation to the accident?
Yeah.
They could have been any of the neighbors.
Right? He's just going to be like, oh yeah, I remember. I heard it was Faith Westman's house on the radio while I was driving over here. I heard that. I don't know. Maybe, but it doesn't seem like the kind of detail you'd pay attention to. You're paying attention to driving. You're paying attention to getting where you're going. You can always radio back and find out where the caller was.
Especially because he's not thinking that he's going to have to necessarily go over to her house right away, because he's not assuming that the person won't be at the car.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if he heard anything, he might have heard that there was someone at the car.
Mm-hmm.
He might have heard that Butch Atwood saw her. So he's expecting he's going to find someone. So in his head, he's probably thinking about what he's going to do when he sees that person.
Mm-hmm.
So it's real weird that he wouldn't have radioed, that he went to, that he would have gone to the Westmans. He would have known specifically where to go. He wouldn't have radioed back to ask or to let them know that he was going to do that or anything. Like, it's just, that's a weird idea. That's a weird theory.
Yeah.
What seems to make more sense was your idea that maybe he got out and walked around. What he said in the interview, that he got out and looked around real quick and then radioed in.
And that would make a lot of sense, because it would correspond exactly to what is in the accident report, which is that he arrived at 7:45 p.m., which is a minute before what is recorded in the official dispatch log, which is 7:46.
Right.
So if we're just going to, just for a second, assume that both the dispatch log is correct and the police report is correct, and that Smith did arrive when the log says he did, approximately between 7:45 and 7:46, that would mean that for Witness A to have seen him, she would have had to have been driving 130 miles an hour.
Which we could probably say for a fact she wasn't.
Mm-hmm. It seems implausible to me.
So it's not that Smith couldn't have arrived at the time when you think Witness A was most likely there. He didn't arrive at a time that we think Witness A could have even possibly been there.
Right.
Yeah. So if the times and logs are roughly accurate, and Smith didn't get there until 7:46, and Witness A arrived at 7:36, mm-hmm. somewhere in there, as late as 7:37. That provides 9 minutes on scene for a police car to have arrived and left before Smith got there. So that car could have been there and he wouldn't even know. And he might be telling 100% the truth. You know, it's also possible that an officer showed up and then saw there was no one there and then went on a search for someone. There's things that could have happened, and nobody necessarily needs to be lying for that to be the case.
Right.
So if you're trying to say that Smith's report of 7:45 and the dispatch log, his arrival time of 7:46, if you're trying to say that both of those are wrong and his actual arrival time is 7:35, and you add plus or minus a couple of minutes to all those, adding plus or minus a couple minutes doesn't make them line up. So to me, you're fitting your narrative, your timeline, you know, the events to fit what you think happened rather than following the data that's there, following the most likely sequence of events.
Mm-hmm.
And I get why that's attractive. You want there to only have been one police officer on the scene. You only know of one police officer, right? Smith's the only person you know who was there. And you have no information to suggest that there was another police officer there, except you have Witness A, who saw a cop car, and you have times that seemingly don't allow for Smith to have been there when she saw the car. So how do you make that work? Either you manipulate the times and try to make it work that way, or you entertain the notion that there was another car. Those are the two options. I mean, to me, one way, you're changing times. You're trying to bend over backwards to change not one time, but two times. Dispatch logs and the report. And you're trying to make it match with the theory that is more attractive to you for whatever reason.
Yes.
Yeah. And here's the thing. Art might say, someone who wants to believe there was only one police officer there might say, well, but you're speculating about a police car. You're trying to add things in to fit your hypothesis, but I'm not really doing that. I'm saying there might be a police car. We're saying there might have been a police car, but we're not manipulating facts. We're just trying to come up with what could be
plausible scenarios based on those facts.
Yeah. What's an explanation? And one explanation is that the times are all wrong, but another explanation is that there was another police car.
And we happen to know of one police car that cleared a scene at 7:28 p.m. for no seemingly necessary reason, but was going somewhere.
Yes. McKay's car cleared from the suicide call, Littleton call, at 7:28, coincidentally, very soon after the police first find out about the car accident via Faith Westman's call. 1 minute. 1 minute after.
Right.
Yeah. And another point that Art raised on the show that I just want to respond to, you know, he mentions if something happened, if another car was there, you know, why didn't Faith Westman see it? Why didn't Butch Atwood see it? Why, there was all these people around. And he makes a good point in saying that, you know, people think this is this remote road. It's not that remote. We were there. There's buildings and houses around, and there are three witnesses. But we know for a fact that these three witnesses did not see what happened to Maura. Maura went missing, and they didn't see it. So if they didn't see Maura go missing, they easily could have missed a police officer arriving at on scene before Smith. Or they saw a police officer arriving before Smith and didn't know that it was a different police officer than the one who came up and talked to them later on.
Exactly.
You know, they said they saw flashing blue lights. They could have seen flashing blue lights from another police officer. And then a few minutes later, Smith pulls up. They don't even know that anything's happened, that it's a different officer. And then the officer comes up and talks to them.
Yes, I completely agree. There's no reason that they would have necessarily made that distinction between one police car and another police car. All they see are blue lights, if anything.
Yeah. Yep, blue lights in pitch black.
So they did not necessarily have to see Maura be abducted and are covering it up. One thing that bothered me a little bit that Art said was that, well, if any of the timeline is off, I forget his exact wording, then we have to believe that Karen McNamara is lying, that John Monahan is lying, that all of the witnesses are lying, that Smith is lying. No, that we don't. We don't have to assume that anyone is lying for another officer to have been there before Smith was. We don't even have to assume that Smith is lying.
Right. And there's lots of things, if you assume that only Smith is lying, that even opens up more possibilities.
Yes.
Regarding the SUV, whether he was in the SUV, whether he was in the sand or whatever. But it's entirely possible there were two SUVs, and I want to get that because we never really talked about that before. He doesn't even have to be lying about being in the SUV. He could have been in the SUV. There could still be another SUV. 001, it's the first car. It's the first number. It's probably the most common numbered vehicle. So why would we assume that just because, okay, let's assume Smith is 100% telling the truth. He was in an SUV. It was marked 001. That doesn't mean, for a fact, that it was the same vehicle that Witness A saw.
Mm-hmm. And I would also just say that I think it's quite possible that he is lying about being in 001.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the only thing he's lying about.
Yep.
And maybe sometimes things that start as really small lies, insignificant, inconsequential lies, you can't backtrack away from because they become...
Yeah.
If Smith were to now say, actually, I took the sedan and I was covering for someone.
Yeah.
Well.
He becomes suspect number one if he does that, and he knows that. Unfairly, I would say, because just because you lied about something doesn't make you a suspect, but people jump
but
all over
it. But it doesn't matter. Yeah. Now, there is the Sokol article that Art doubts the veracity of, but which states that Smith was at the Haverhill Police Department when he was dispatched. And I would just say that the route that he described, Route 10 to Swiftwater to Sawyer Hill to 112, would line up with him being at or near the Haverhill Police Department, which is on Route 10. So that's not an isolated fact, as it was sort of portrayed. There is more information that corroborates, information from Cecil himself, that corroborates the possibility or the likelihood that he was on or near the grounds of the Haverhill Police Department, on Route 10 somewhere.
Yeah. So his explanation was he took Swiftwater to Sawyer Hill to get on 112.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if he took Sawyer Hill Road, he's backtracking for that part of the trip.
Yeah.
So, like, okay, you were trying to shave off a couple miles, but now you're losing, you're going the wrong direction. And admitting that doing this caused the person who you had just flown past to catch up with you.
Yeah.
It's a strange thing to say. It's a strange explanation to come up with, and especially a strange thing to say without acknowledging that, like, boy, that didn't work out, did it? Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, they almost made it seem like the fact that the SUV passed, when you say twice, they almost like seemed to imply that that meant that he was speeding like so fast that he like lapped them around the universe or something like that. But it actually means...
It means he went fast to pass her and then slowed down.
Right.
And then went fast again.
Yeah. It implies that he was actually going slower than you might expect, not faster.
Yeah. It's real weird. Or he took a slower route anyway. Like, that's the thing. Like, in order for him to pass her twice, he had to take a different route, right? He had to pass her, go off somewhere, and then come back. That's the only way. Well, or it was two different vehicles.
Yes.
So now I suppose you could say if your argument was, well, yeah, he did that. He went off like he was going somewhere else and he was going so fast that even doing that, he was able to catch back up with her. But then it begs the question, like, but why did he do that?
Mm-hmm. Right. It's questionable.
It's just there's no explanation. And that's what's so weird to me about this is that nobody is acknowledging, not Art, Maggie, or Smith has acknowledged how odd it is that a police officer is claiming that, basically saying, yeah, I passed her, and then, like, I took a route that resulted in her beating me and me having to pass her again. Basically, I took a terrible route because I'm supposedly flying, responding to an emergency, lights are on, and somehow this woman who's driving roughly the speed limit or slower caught up to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's... to me, really hard to explain. Someone diverting off, someone who was heading a different direction and then coming back, doubling back, for whatever reason, that makes more sense.
Right.
So either it's Smith and he got lost and went the totally wrong direction, or it's somebody else. Either way, his current statement as to his route doesn't really make a lot of sense to me, if he is the car that Wednesday saw.
Yeah, and so you know what time she would have passed the corner of Goose Lane, like near the Swiftwater station?
Yeah.
You know what time that would have been if we're assuming that she made the call at 7:52? Would have been right around 7:28.
Yeah.
7:28, 7:29. Now think about that. Who cleared a call at 7:28 p.m.? Who was heading perhaps toward Littleton, turns around right at 7:29, right when she was there.
Yeah, it was Bruce McKay.
Mm-hmm.
That is, to me, that explanation makes way more sense than that somehow the cop who passed her took a terrible route, won't admit it, but will acknowledge that he passed her again.
So, and we should go back to the witnesses. They brought up the witnesses and the witnesses seeing the SUV 001 and Cecil.
Right.
I don't know where those statements came from. I think everything that I've read, every news article, there's never a mention of a car.
No.
But if we're going to assume that that's true, that they commented on which car the police officers were in at all, which seems like a very strange question to be asking witnesses. Oh, yeah.
Very strange.
But the fact that they're even asking the question should be a signal that perhaps something was off about who was driving which car. Because why else would that be a question?
Right.
Why did they call witness A twice to confirm what car she saw?
Yeah, and she was very clear that that happened. You know, I can't tell because Maggie says that Atwood said that it was Cecil Smith in 001. And then she walks it back and she says, oh, no, he said it was Smith, but it doesn't say 001. And then Art says it was the Westmans.
Yeah, without seeing sources on any of those things, or without getting a direct statement from the New Hampshire State Police, I don't know that we can accept it as fact.
Right, and I wouldn't accept any of those, but what I would say is, if someone told me that, oh yeah, the witness said that they saw Officer X in vehicle number Y, my first thought would be, why would that person have remembered that? Why would a witness ever say that?
Unless they were asked.
Unless they were asked. Now, with the caveat that witness A, Karen, did say that without anyone asking her.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I remember it was vehicle 001. So it can happen that a witness can volunteer specific information. But she had a specific reason for remembering that, which is the vehicle flew past her very fast. She saw it because it went right past her. She was that close to the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And then passed her again. So that kind of burned it into her memory. Why would the Westmans ever think about or notice the number on Smith's car? They didn't leave their house. How would they have even gotten close enough to see it? Atwood, you could say, well, maybe he would have noticed because Smith drove up to him.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't claim. I mean, Maggie claims, but then retracts that, Atwood said he saw 001. And as far as we know, nobody says it. The only information we have that anyone besides Witness A said they saw 001 was Art saying on the show that New Hampshire State Police said the Westmans said it.
Well, and he doesn't even say that. He says he thinks it's the Westmans.
He thinks it's the Westmans, yeah.
So let's just be clear, because what Art said is that the New Hampshire State Police said that a witness saw the SUV 001. He's assuming that it is the Westmans.
A witness, right. Which to me, it's more likely actually that it would be Atwood, right?
Maybe.
If.
Wait. Maybe it's Karen.
Is the witness A?
It probably is. Yeah, because that is the only witness that we're aware of that saw the SUV.
And she's also, other than Butch Atwood, she's the most likely to have seen it.
Mm-hmm.
The Westmans certainly wouldn't have seen it. I don't see how they could even possibly have made out the number on the vehicle or bother.
Even if they could, the question is why would they either offer that information or why were they being questioned about it?
Right. If they did specify that, yeah, why would someone even ask that?
So my guess is that the witness that the New Hampshire State Police have on record is Witness A, not the Westmans.
Yeah, probably.
And what about Officer Monahan? What did he see?
Yes, right? Because his interview, as we saw on the Oxygen show, they didn't ask him, did they?
They did not air his response to the question about what vehicle.
Right. Well, they didn't air that they even asked the question, which I remember was a complaint we had at the time. Like, why didn't you ask Monahan what he saw?
And it turns out they did ask Monahan what he saw, and I'll read that. So Art asks, have you heard anything about Witness A? John says, no. Art says, about, 001 Cruiser being at the scene prior to Cecil Smith showing up. John says, right, that was one of the things that somebody said, hey, did you see that there's this new theory? And I read it briefly. It's not what I saw. I pulled up and Cecil was there. And then I left. I don't believe anyone else showed up afterwards, but you'd have to ask Cecil Smith if somebody did. And he was the only officer there when I was there. Art says, I mean, Cecil was driving a sedan, right? John says, I believe he was. Art says, yeah. John says, I believe he was. That's something I'm not 100% on, but I think he was in the Crown Vic that evening.
Yeah.
So we have at least what I would consider to be perhaps the most credible on this particular fact, because he actually spoke to Smith at the vehicle. He was actually in his own vehicle, rolled down the window, and spoke to Smith, who was in the other vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Of anyone, I think that he probably has one of the more trustworthy or credible, reliable memories. First, he's saying he didn't see the 001 Cruiser. Then he's saying he believes, but is not 100% sure, that he saw the sedan and specifies the Crown Vic.
Yes. So on that first part, he didn't see the 001 Cruiser. I'm not quite sure how to interpret that. I guess me hearing that, I interpreted it as he didn't see another car there. Like, he was referring to the theory that there was another police officer. And he's basically saying, well, I didn't see that. I didn't see another police officer.
I grant that that's it's definitely ambiguous. I think that what he's referring to is the theory that Jeff Williams was in 001.
Right. Right. That is probably. Yeah. Yeah.
Because he says, it's not what I saw. I pulled up and Cecil was there. So to me, he's linking that theory and 001 with the theory that somebody else other than Cecil, which was presumably in this case, Jeff Williams,
mm-hmm.
in 001. So that's how I interpret it.
Yeah. I can see it going either way on that one.
Mm-hmm.
What's not going either way, what's pretty clear is that his recollection is that it was the sedan, the Crown Vic, that mm-hmm. he saw. Now, with the caveat that Art asked a leading question, he asked him if it was the sedan.
Yes, it would have been better if he didn't.
Yes, if he didn't lead him. Yes, it would be better for our purposes if he didn't lead him to that question, because then you wouldn't have the doubt of, oh, well, did he only say it was the sedan because Art led him there? But then he specifies the Crown Vic. So to me, he had an image in his mind prior to Art asking the question of what car he thought it was. And, you know, he does say he's not 100% sure, but what he recalls and says he recalls,
to the best of his knowledge,
is the sedan.
Yes.
Which is a contradicting statement.
Right. I don't know why we would necessarily assume that anyone else had a better recollection or a better, more credible memory than the officer that was there that spoke to him from his car.
Well, so the only person who would be Smith, right? Because he'd be more likely to remember what car he was in than Monahan. So if we're going to trust Monahan's memory, then we have to say, well, then Smith was definitely lying, right? If we believe Monahan, then Smith has to be lying, because if Monahan remembers based on a one-off interaction, then certainly Smith would remember from having been in the car that whole night which vehicle it was. That's the only problem I see with believing Monahan. Otherwise, would there be any question? If we didn't have Smith's statement, if we didn't have Smith saying he was in the SUV, and we just had Monahan saying what he said to Art, I believe that's correct. I'm not 100% sure, but I believe he was in the Crown Vic. We would say, okay, he was probably in the Crown Vic. He was probably in the sedan. The only contradictory data to that is Smith's statement on the Oxygen Show.
Yep. That's it.
So, it's not a slam dunk, obviously, but it just kind of goes to show we've got to throw away something that somebody says. We've either got to throw away what Smith says as wrong, or we've got to say that Monahan's recollection is not that accurate, in which case, well, you know, then we're kind of saying, well, all these people could have misremembered certain things,
which means we have to go back to the data.
Yes, exactly.
Which says that Smith was there at 7:46.
Yeah, it's like you can't throw away Monahan saying he saw the sedan and then take as gospel anything else that anyone says. You know, you can't have it both ways,
right? Oh, I did want to bring up one of the things that I think either Art or Maggie or both said was that, well, Maura couldn't have gone east because Karen didn't see her.
Yes.
And I would point out that there are two ways to go east. There's to continue on 112 or to take a right on Bradley Hill Road.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, Rick Forcier is, as far as we know, the only suspect that has ever been named or mentioned or implied, I should say, by any officer that actually worked on her case. That's in some ways the most credible piece of information that we have about the case. So I don't think it can be discounted. And the access point to Rick Forcier's trailer was actually on Bradley Hill Road. It was not on Route 112. So I don't think that we should discount the idea that she may have walked east.
Uh-huh.
And just taking a right on Bradley Hill Road. Just because witness A didn't see her doesn't mean that she did not travel in an easterly direction.
Right. At some point. Yeah. And for that matter, she could have even gone east up 112 and simply been picked up before witness A passed.
Right. Yeah. So I wasn't really sure why they were so sure about that particular fact.
I think to me that is a attempt to sort of placate Fred, or to sort of say, well, Fred, don't get so worked up about nobody going east, nobody searching east, because we know at least one person drove that way and they didn't see her. So if you have this image in your mind of Maura wandering like miles down 112 and nobody finding her,
I see.
You know, put that out of your head, because Karen would have seen her. And that I do agree with. You know, I kind of agree. Look,
yeah.
She wasn't wandering down Route 112 looking for someone to help her, and nobody's thinking to search. Well, it is apparently possible that no one thought to search east, but that didn't happen. Because again, witness A would have seen her. But like you said, she might have gone down a different road. And if there was a search to the east, it probably would have gone down 112. And she still would have been missed if she went down Bradley Hill.
This is why the timeline matters, though, because you can only get so far on foot in any direction, right? So if she had only been alone for 7 minutes, you can only get about a half a mile.
Yeah.
So you don't have to search that far. You can go down a mile or two. You can come back around and go down Bradley Hill Road.
It's true. Come back, search another road. Yeah.
It makes no sense to extend the route 15 miles because nobody can get that far on foot.
Right. Right, in the time
like
frame.
What they really should have done is kept it to assuming that she is on foot, which is the assumption that they made because it's in the Bolo.
Yeah.
It should really be concentrated within like 2 miles, like a mile radius.
2 mile radius. Every road within a 2 mile radius.
Yeah.
Should have been searched. Yeah.
Again, hindsight is 2020. But
sure. I mean, it really has the feel of they weren't looking all that hard.
Mm-hmm.
They really just thought it was a drunk driver, abandoned vehicle. Now, to me, that's insane. What is your hypothesis as to what this person is actually doing in the middle of the night to evade being picked up? I just don't get it. Again, like, okay, yes, they see it all the time, but winter, night.
No streetlights,
not close to town center, out of state plates. This is not the most likely case of a person avoiding DUI. I suppose if you're Smith, you might reason, oh, maybe she's got friends up here and she called her friends and they picked her up and she'll come by the station tomorrow and pick up her car. Okay, I guess maybe, but again, is that like a reasonable assumption to make? Is that something that we should just excuse and say like, oh, that, yeah, that's totally makes sense. Out of state plate. Well, she probably figured out some way. She's nowhere near a town. She's miles from a town center where she could get a hotel or anything. Wherever she was going, by the way, was east.
Yeah, and I share the frustration that nobody looked east because everyone had just come from the west. Smith came from the west. Monahan came from the west. Nobody saw her. So again, if you believe she's on foot, the logical conclusion that you would draw is that she didn't go to the west.
Right, because you just came from that direction.
Two officers just came from the same direction.
Yeah.
And not only that, but the whole point that Monahan was coming to the scene is because his jurisdiction was right to the east.
Right.
He knew at that point that Atwood was searching in a westerly direction. He had just come from the west.
Yes.
Why did he decide to go back toward the west when he knows that a person can only get so far on foot? It just makes no sense unless somebody did go east. Because we've not actually ever heard anyone, the police, anyone else, ever say that no one went east.
Sure, that's what Fred says.
Yes, that's what Fred has inferred based on the statements that he has, that we all have, that the search by Smith was contained to a certain area. Atwood went west, Monahan went west.
Right.
But no one actually has ever said that nobody went east.
Right. That's not a fact.
That is an assumption that we're all making, an inference that we're drawing from the information that we have. It's quite possible, I believe, that there's a piece of information out there that indicates that somebody did go east. And until I hear the New Hampshire State Police say that no one went east.
Right.
Or any kind of evidence to that effect, then I think it's certainly possible.
It's definitely possible. And just real quick on the discussion of who searched where. And Monahan specifically, on the last episode, Missing More Murray, they discuss, you know, that Fred kind of unfairly goes off on Monahan. You know, Monahan's his guy. But I would say, from Fred's perspective, I kind of get it. Because, you know, Art and Maggie kind of made the point, well, Monahan didn't have anything to do with anything. He wasn't there until much later. But Fred's looking at this from the perspective of, you guys are the state police. And Fred accurately points out that the East is Monahan's jurisdiction. So it is a legitimate question. Why didn't you search East? It's not like a crazy thing to say, like, why did you not go to the East, Monahan? Specifically Monahan. To specifically ask him why he chose to go west.
Yes.
If Smith told him to go west, which he doesn't say, but if Smith told him to go, why didn't he say, well, why didn't I search to the East? You know, like, it's a legitimate question. I wouldn't accuse Monahan of being like grossly negligent or being nefarious in any way, but I do think it's a fair criticism.
Not only that, but think about it in the context in which Mr. Murray is learning this information.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first he's told there was a state cop there, and he asked the state police and they say, no, there wasn't.
Right.
Then he finds out that actually there was, but you can't talk to him and you can't know anything about what he did.
Yeah, you can only talk to me, the Scorinza.
Right. And we can't tell you what he did or anything about his narrative statement or anything else. So you're getting that conflicting information about Monahan. I think one of the rhetorical questions that they asked in the show that I was glad that they did, but I wished was not rhetorical, was if it had such a simple answer, why didn't they just tell Mr. Murray this 14 years ago or 13 years ago?
Yeah, the lack of a report from Monahan.
Right. They never explained that, well, the lieutenant didn't know because he didn't do a detailed report. He did a general service report. Why didn't they say that?
Yeah.
So I have a hard time blaming him for being upset and perhaps frustrated and distrustful of...
Sure.
...of the state police in particular.
Yes. And Monahan was there and he didn't search east. So mm-hmm. A decision was made on his part. And, you know, I'm not going to rake him over the coals for it, but I don't blame Fred for asking tough questions and for being upset, certainly, and directing his anger in the general direction of state police.
Right.
I think to say that, like, there's no reason for him to, you know, to go after Monahan, I don't think that's accurate. There is a reason.
There is a reason. I would say that I think that he was following orders. So I don't blame him per se, but I blame his bosses and the state police.
Definitely.
They have to understand how it's going to be interpreted.
Yeah.
And if they don't, it's on them.
Yeah. Yeah. Why would you be shocked that a father of a missing girl who you can't find is upset with one of your guys,
mm-hmm.
who you won't let say anything and you won't give him any information? And all the information you're giving him implies that you didn't do your job, right?
Right.
No one should be surprised by what happened, really, at this point.
Exactly. Yeah.